The Guardian.
The Guardian has partnered with audible.co.uk to offer listeners a free audiobook when you sign up for a one-month, no-commitment trial of the Audible service. Audible has over 50,000 audiobook titles available to download. Go to guardian.co.uk/audible for further details.
Hello and welcome to Tech Weekly from The Guardian. I'm Alex Kratosky, and as Charles said on last week's podcast, I was away finishing a book. Writing, not reading, but I'm back now. Hello. Now this week we hear from author Andrew Blum about the tubes of the internet, things that deliver the web to our living rooms and offices. What happens when a squirrel chews through the cable that connects us with the rest of the world? And we're discussing what the results of Google's EU antitrust case mean for the way the search giant delivers results. Charles Arthur joins me, and he'll be filling us in on the impending doom, or not, at RIM, and an update on Microsoft's first reported quarterly loss since it's become a public company. This is Tech Weekly from The Guardian. First off, Charles, we've been following the apparent demise of RIM over the past few months. What's the latest? Give us an update.
RIM has made its second operating loss in a row, and things don't look to be improving anymore because it's put off the launch of its BlackBerry 10 platform until the first quarter of 2013. A lot of people are wondering whether it can really survive. Some of the analysts are putting out notes saying, well, if they don't do something pretty dramatic, then they're going to run out of cash and that's it.
Yeah, just go into playing cards or something, you know what I mean? Just literally make a left turn.
Do a reverse Nintendo.
Yeah, yes. Exactly. But seriously, like, especially because all the headlines are screaming burning platform. They're screaming, geez, what's going on? It is kind of like watching a car crash.
It is a bit. I mean, it does remind me very much of Apple in 1995, 6, 7, when it was just having a tremendously bad time. Developers were deserting it. It wasn't able to come up with the platform it needed, and it needed Steve Jobs to come in, shake it very thoroughly by the neck, slim down the product line, cut costs, get the supply chain really working, come up with a new platform, and eventually move to new products, new ways of thinking with the iPod. And I think actually RIM could do that. They could slim down the product line very substantially because they have dozens of phones. They could do with four. That would simplify choice and it would simplify the supply chain for them. They could cut costs, and they're already trying to do that. But I think Torsten Hines just isn't visionary enough to really lead them through this valley of darkness that they're in.
And the other story is Microsoft. Microsoft has also had a bit of a blow, hasn't it?
Microsoft looks as though it's going to record its first net loss as a public company when it reports its results on 17th of July. This is because overnight it wrote down the value of its Aquantive acquisition, which it made in May of 2007, from $6.3 billion to pretty much zero. It's taking a $6.2 billion charge against it. Now, when it announces what it's expected to be a loss, it might even be a billion-dollar loss. When it announces this, that won't mean that Microsoft has suddenly fallen into the same sort of pit the RIM is in. It's going to be making money hand over fist still on Office and on Windows. It's still going to be losing money, I expect, on Bing and the other online services that Aquantive is part of. What it means is that it's saying the value of the company is not the same as it was, so we have to recognize that. So it's a sort of an accounting thing, really.
But the focus is on this particular company that it acquired, which is an online advertising company.
Yes.
Does that mean that it's going to go elsewhere to look for its online advertising solutions, or is it going to try and rejig this particular organization, or is it just going to say, you know what, we're just going to go with Google Ads?
Well, what I'm hearing is that the acquisition of Aquantive, which was an online advertising network, it was very worried Microsoft back in 2007 when Google bought DoubleClick, which has been a very successful acquisition. It was very worried and it jumped on the Aquantive. But what I'm hearing is that there's just nothing that Microsoft has been able to make use of from Aquantive. Microsoft doesn't seem to be very good at doing big acquisitions, which may bode badly for Skype. We'll have to see how that goes. So, it's rather hard to see. They've said they're not expecting to make as much money out of online services as they once did. And the analysts don't hold up a lot of hope on that either now.
Thank you. Google this week delivered a letter to the European Commission's competition commissioner, Joachim Almunia, setting out its responses to his concerns over Google's monopoly in search and online advertising. Charles, what were the concerns that that were listed?
The first one was about how Google ranks its own products when it comes to search results. So if you're doing searches on shopping, if you're doing searches on video, if you're doing searches on maps, oh, look, there's Google shopping links, there are Google videos, there's Google Maps, all those sorts of things come up in the top of the results. And the complaint, which this goes back to November 2010, when the EC announced it would first start looking into this, as a result of lobbying by a British company called Foundom, and also Microsoft and Chiao and a number of other companies in different parts of the continent. The concern was that things were all hunky-dory in terms of search listings until Google decided to get into a market, and then suddenly Google's product would always come up top. And Foundom has some very interesting graphics that they say illustrate this. Another concern was about Google's scraping of content from sites such as Yelp, reviews and so on. That seems to have changed since the EC announced the investigation.
What were they doing with that scraping?
Effectively that the search results would show what was in the reviews, so there was no point in going to the site. Google, in effect, was shortcutting and taking out revenue away from those sites. The third concern was about how portable it was if you were doing your advertising using Google and you wanted to export your campaign, in effect, to another platform such as Microsoft. The complaint was about the difficulty of doing that. And the other one was to do with whether you could use other advertising networks on Google-owned ones, and whether you could, whether Google demanded exclusivity and monopoly in certain areas. So it's a fair range of things. What most people are focused on is the search listings one, about why is it that Google Maps comes up so highly when you do a search for map things, and it'll be very interesting to see the meat of what Google has said here, because if Google here does agree to change the way it does its search listings, that's a big step.
Well, it's a big step, not just for Europe, but I imagine globally.
Well, it's important as well, because in the US, the Federal Trade Commission is doing the same sort of investigation, and they have heard the same sorts of concerns expressed in the Senate. And again, will the offer be the same in Europe as in the US? Will Google be looking to say, actually, we think we're fine, there's no trouble here at all?
Is there any indication of what might be the offerings that Google has thrown back at us?
Google says it's cooperating, and the commission is indicating, by the way that Almunia is handling it, that it doesn't want to have to go through a long, drawn-out court process. Because to some extent, that doesn't make any difference when you have a monopoly position. With Microsoft, they went through the whole court's fines. The fine was finally upheld last week by the highest European court. And actually, it hasn't really made much difference in terms of how Microsoft operates in the market. It might have changed its approach to how it does things. And I suspect that might be the more interesting outcome, is if it does change Google's approach to how it does things, how it thinks about launching new services.
I mean, you said it there. It's got a monopoly, but this isn't necessarily Google's fault. People will do simple clicks, and they want to do as few clicks as possible, and Google is simply delivering stuff. And so people will say, oh, fantastic, I don't need to go through to that link to read Yelp's review, it's given it to me right there.
The EC takes a slightly different view of monopoly from the US. In the US, if you have a monopoly, that's fine, but it's bad, it's illegal to exploit that monopoly to gain monopoly in another area, as Microsoft did with Windows and Internet Explorer. In the European Commission, in the European Union area, it's slightly different. If you have a monopoly at all, you have to sort of behave well with it. And the search listings, the advertising, those sorts of things all come under that. It's not necessarily saying that Google is trying to extend from one place into another. It's saying you have to actually do well by people, which is a different sort of philosophy.
So absolutely. So in fact, you gave the example of Windows operating system and Internet Explorer, and Internet Explorer as the browser would be the other area that, because it was bundled with Windows, that was the problem with the Microsoft issue. Here, or rather in Europe, if you've got the Google offerings, it doesn't really matter that they also happen to have Maps, they also happen to have Docs, they also happen to have all these different things.
Well, it sort of does if you have other map providers who want to get into the business.
Need to leave the door open a bit and say these other people can come in.
Well, you have to say, be transparent about how you do your search listings. How is it you choose that Google Maps appears top? Why does Google, what's the secret amazing source that Google Maps has that puts them top rather than Bing Maps or, I don't know, Nokia Maps or, you know, TomTom Maps? You know, if all of these are available, why don't they appear? Ordnance Survey is quite well known for their maps. They, you know, why are they?
So what does this actually mean if Google does, I wouldn't say capitulate, but if Google does make concessions, as it were, to the European Commission, what does this actually sort of mean for the relationship between internet organizations and government regulation?
I think it will be a very significant step in terms of how US businesses see the EU. They might even see it as retrograde. They might feel that they want to be wary. But at the same time, the only way to get a monopoly is, hey, by being very popular. So, you know, businesses tend not to turn away from that. And it's not as if Google is losing money in Europe. You know, actually, Europe is one of its biggest markets. Britain is one of its most profitable markets. So I think that you could say that it's not necessarily a bad thing, but it puts a crimp on its style.
And it's interesting as well that the European Commission have said, we like what you do, we just like it if you kind of fell into step, as opposed to what, say, the Chinese government was trying to do with Google, which is perhaps why they didn't continue to play ball with that region, even though that's also quite a large market that they could potentially have exploited.
The Chinese situation is slightly different, in as much as Sergey Brin certainly did not want to be there and he thought it was a bad idea. Larry Page was of the same mind, but Eric Schmidt suggested to them that they needed to be in China. And actually, when the whole hacking thing, what's reckoned to be government-inspired hacking of Gmail to get at Tibetan activists happened, that's when Page and Brin pulled the plug on that. So they are, to some extent, pragmatists, to some extent, realists, but, you know, they always have a tinge of optimism about it. Yeah, they'd like to be
there. They? They're such dreamers, and it's nice. It is nice to have that at that corporate level, given what we're experiencing with the rest of the corporate level in the rest of the global banking sector. Anyway, what is the next stage? When will we hear what's happening next?
What we'd expect to see next is that Almunia's office, having looked over the response, once they've decided whether they think it's suitable, whether it answers their concerns, there'll be what's called market testing. That is, they publish it and say, hey, everyone, what do you think of this? And it'll be really interesting to see what Microsoft and Chow and Foundum respond to that. So we don't have an exact timetable on it, but you'd expect it would happen in the next few months.
The internet, according to Alaskan Senator Ted Stevens, is a series of tubes. Well, according to the U.S. representative, who at the time was making a comment on net neutrality as the representative of the U.S. government in charge of regulating the internet, he thought that this explained why things slowed down or sped up according to how much or how little traffic was clogging these tubes up. Now, he has been widely criticized for his metaphor, but it turns out, according to author Andrew Blum, that the internet is a series of tubes. Andrew joins me now. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
I'm very curious, actually, about how you kind of landed on this idea. It has something to do with a squirrel.
It does. It does. A rascally squirrel. I was writing mostly about architecture, about buildings, and realizing that I was spending more and more time not out looking at buildings, but sitting in front of my screen. And not only that, but since getting an iPhone, was then getting up at the end of the day and looking at the screen I carried in my pocket. And then my internet at home broke, and the guy came to fix it, and he followed the cable from behind my couch out to the back of my building, and then saw a squirrel running along a wire and said, I think that's your problem. I think a squirrel is chewing on your internet.
Instead of bugs, you've got critters.
And I realized, I got this image in my head of what would happen if I yanked the cable from the wall. And could you actually follow it? Were there other pieces of the internet that squirrels could chew on?
And there is. What's fascinating then is applying this idea of architecture to, sort of a physical architecture to something that we very much consider a conceptual phenomenon, you know, something that we navigate through our screens. I imagine that certainly had a very good effect on how you conceptualize the internet when you were researching the book.
It meant certainly leaving a lot out. You know, I like to think of the internet in these three ways. There's the kind of logical way of algorithms and protocols, and that's how we mostly deal with it. We deal with it as the things that show up on our screen. But there's also the physical, what it actually is made of, the machines, and the geographic, where it is. So I was focused, I decided to focus primarily on the physical and the geographic, on what color the walls were and why it was where it was and who put it there.
In 1996, I remember I was living in Washington, D.C. It was just before I moved over here. I finished college and I went back to my mom's house. This is the age of America Online. And I remember the most glorious day that the internet broke. And the internet broke because AOL broke. And I have since been completely obsessed with this idea of being unable to access the web. Everything that we are dependent upon nowadays has really been migrated online. And I'm wondering about your doomsday scenario. Is it possible for, and I've asked folks from, you know, all over the shop, VeriSign, the whole lot, is it possible to unplug the internet? And I'm curious about your take since you've done quite a lot of research on this.
Well, logically, I think something could go very wrong with a domain name system. Some bug could sort of percolate very quickly around the world and could shut things down. Physically, though, I don't think so. Physically, though, I kind of believe in the redundancy and robustness of the infrastructure that we've built. In Tubes, the network engineers are kind of my heroes, and they're very proud of this, what they've created. Obviously, there are realms of it they can't control. But at least in the buildings and in the way that the mesh of networks that are physically connected to each other, they're quite comfortable with the strength of that.
So robust they are, and that is ultimately part of the way that Vint Cerf and Bob Kahn built the TCP/IP protocol. So how information is rooted and rerouted, and you know you can't necessarily cut it off, as evidenced during the Egyptian issues during the Arab Spring, when Egypt tried to turn the internet off, but of course there were lots and lots of different ways of getting information out. But I'm curious about the idea of where we are now, 40 odd years, almost 50 years on since the development of this system. This system was built from a particular perspective, and now it seems as if we've almost achieved an entrenchment. Is this actually the best way that the internet was built?
It's interesting. I mean, there's this notion that when something arrives on our screen, it's happened automatically. The bits have found their way through these sort of multiple paths. But what's been striking for me to recognize is that only happens because of the independent decisions made by two network engineers, usually over beers, deciding that it makes sense for me to connect my network to your network, and then consummating that connection physically with this yellow fiber optic cable connecting these two routers. And so when you start to look at the internet as made of these independent decisions made by two network engineers, it starts to both seem a lot less automatic and a lot less kind of centrally controlled. Yes, things could go wrong, and yes, things are very concentrated, but I also have a lot of affection for this sort of basic philosophical idea that still holds, that the internet is a network of networks, and as long as you connect one network to another, the rest will follow. And as long as each network is interested in this strange combination of their own self-interest, it's what's best for us, but also the recognition that we only can exist as a network on the internet if we can connect to other networks. We cannot be alone. No network can be an island. We have to sort of connect. And that the sort of tension between those ideas, between their self-interest and their need to have a sort of mutual interest across the network as a whole, I think is what keeps things going.
Is it neutral, though? I mean, there is a politic. As you say, it's a couple of guys or women.
Very rarely, which is another issue with these folks.
Well, indeed. I mean, there's a politic, there's an ideology, there are certain biases, whether it's over beers or, whether it's over dinner or whatever, that, sure, yeah, I'll connect my cable, I'll connect my network to your network. Sure, yeah, or I won't connect my network to your network because I don't like you, or we haven't had a round of golf recently. So we do start to see these human biases that are built into this technology.
Utterly, utterly. And it's very clicky, in fact. And it was striking for me to get to the heart of that click, predominantly in this group called the NANOG, the North American Network Operators Group, that is not only North American, but brings a lot of the big players from Europe and Asia, and to recognize that they have a very intense social environment. They have lots of interpersonal history among them, 200, 300 people, not a large group, but the connections between some of the largest networks in the world are rooted in that social relationship.
This is sort of a Brandenburg cabal.
Absolutely. They don't like when you use the word cabal, but they know it fits a little bit. And part of the reason they don't like it is because they recognize that the functioning of the network depends on their ability to operate somewhat autonomously as engineers, regardless of the pressure that's exerted on them from their corporate parents. But it indicates as well that there is no public internet. You know, these are entirely private networks operating, again, in this weird tension between their own self-interest and the need for the internet to work as a whole. So that's always there, but it still always comes down to these individual decisions. And there aren't very many people other than this group who understands really technically what's behind those decisions in order to say, oh, we should have done it some other way.
And the fact that they are called North American, although you did mention that there are players in there within this 200 to 300 person group from Europe and from Asia, obviously it started with North America. And so I imagine there are biases that are built into that, just simply by the nature of how people conceive of information as free or networks as open or closed. Can you tell me a little bit about what you found in that area?
Well, I think the thing that was most striking is that the sort of delicate symbiosis between the sort of international networks, the backbones between the local ISPs, whether in Sweden or Virginia or wherever it is, and the big content providers, most especially the Googles and the Facebooks and the Amazons, the relationship between them was changing. And the thing that's striking to me is that the most threatening piece is when any single network gets too big, when any single network is no longer just a content provider, but is a global carrier in its own right.
And who represents this kind of?
Well, Facebook and Google are particularly interesting. I mean, Google now Google's not just a data center that the internet comes in and plugs into, and then Google's connected to the internet. Google now has an incredibly substantial global network of its own, and then is connecting to everyone else in a relatively short list of buildings around the world. And so that...
which you can see on Google Maps.
all of which you can see on Google Maps, except, of course, Google's own buildings, which they often obscure on Google Maps. Although recently they have been switching out some new satellite photos, much to my disappointment, because, again, it was amazing to me that that one network could control information to that degree when so much of the infrastructure of the internet was, in fact, quite open because of this sort of character of a bazaar that everyone has to connect to everyone else. So if the whole thing kind of depends on this relatively symbiotic relationship of networks, or this sort of delicate balance of I'll give you my traffic, you give me yours, I'll provide the transatlantic link, but you'll provide the eyeballs in this part of the world. As that balance shifts, whether with a very large network like Comcast in the US, which is now a very dominant ISP, or Google is a very dominant content provider moving into the ISP, becoming an ISP in one notable project in Kansas, that things start to shift around, and we end up with a sort of new typology of the internet potentially coming.
Now that's at a different layer ultimately than ultimately the tubes, than even ultimately the protocols that were initially listed and built to route all of the information in all of the different ways from one network to another, and never being contained necessarily by an individual corporation or an individual country. But having looked quite closely at the various players, whether it's at the content provider layer, whether it's at the operator layer, whether it's even at the layer of the architecture of the tubes themselves and the systems of the tubes and how they are connected. Can you envisage a way in which this system would be better built or would have been better built, given that now we are where we are? And as I mentioned before, it feels very much entrenched. It feels like we're stuck in many ways with this particular network.
Well, it's interesting. I confess that I have a bit of Stockholm syndrome, and that I've kind of, Tubes is very much a sort of love letter to the network engineers who've built this thing that for the most part works. But for me, the part that's most striking is at the ISP level, is the part that's closest to us. And I've, often been asked recently, what's the value in knowing this? Does it really change the way we use the internet? And what's striking to me is that the internet is absolutely, absolutely the dominant way that most of us receive our information. And yet we have almost no choice about where we get it from. We can choose 15 different varieties of tomatoes or, 30 different varieties of coffee drink, but our dominant source of information, for the most part, we have one choice or maybe two choices. And at the moment that there haven't been substantial consequences to that. But it seems to me, both in terms of capacity issues, as we want to watch more and more video online, and sometimes it doesn't work because the tubes are clogged, or in terms of political issues, in ISPs being asked to both save their user logs or things like that, that there are going to be more issues that come to the front where we want to know where our internet comes from. And so the analogy that I've been using is similar to food. You know, 10 or 15 years ago, if you asked where your vegetables came from, people would think that was such a silly question. What do you mean? It tastes like a vegetable. What does it matter? Who grew it? And that's become a very, you know, that's become a big issue. And that starting with consumer choice and then leading to changes in the production system itself. So I think the thing that I would like to see different is, you know, both more choice and more transparency in where we get our internet from. And I think also, I mean, it kind of snuck up on us as this dominant information source. You know, 10 years ago, which at the sort of tail end of the broadband boom, when there was a lot of discussion about who owns the internet, who's building the internet, where it's coming from, the internet was still someplace you went occasionally. You still logged on. And certainly in the last 10 years since, our relationship to it has changed pretty dramatically. But we haven't really, our understanding of what goes into it hasn't caught up. You know, it's become this sort of dominant object in our life, but yet we don't yet have the understanding of what's going on behind it.
Well, let's take a kind of sidestep here then. You mentioned broadband and you mentioned sort of not really thinking about what goes into it. Let's talk about this from a very practical point of view. Mm-hmm. Tell me about, you know, I pay for broadband access. Where does that money go?
Well, the internet's never free. I mean, we know that. So some of that is going into, certainly the most obvious part is the way in which is the maintenance and construction of the lines actually feeding your house.
The getting rid of the squirrels, basically.
Getting rid of the squirrels, the squirrel prevention department. And then but then certainly another piece goes closer to the center of the internet. At the buildings, for example, in the UK, at Telehouse in the Docklands, where networks connect to each other, where your ISP connects to a Facebook, to a Google, to other ISPs, to international backbone networks. And at that point, there most likely is a financial transaction where your ISP is paying a big international backbone, whether a Level 3 or a Tata or some other company that owns the transatlantic or transpacific cables. So they're paying your airline ticket there, and that's in your bill somewhere. In a very, you know, somewhere embedded in there is that price. Embedded in that, of course, is the construction cost, the $300 million it took to lay one of those cables. Embedded in that is the maintenance of the cable. So when it breaks, a ship goes out. A very expensive process to actually physically pick the cable up off the ground. So we're used to the internet, but there's a strange dichotomy. Sometimes we say the internet is free, and yet we pay quite a bit for it at home. You know, we all pay for it somewhere along the line, or Starbucks pays for it for us. And we don't recognize, I think, that because it is entirely privately owned, there is no public internet whatsoever. We have this term public internet for the sort of mushing together of many different private networks. But because it is all privately owned, somebody's always paying. Not that it's the best business to be at the center of the internet. These companies have never done particularly well.
Really? Like the infrastructure companies aren't making loads. I mean, they are ultimately, they're the people who have the potential to turn it off or slice the cable.
The Level 3s, the Tatas, they've it's not clear that they've ever really caught up from the incredible expense of building these networks in the first place 10 years ago. So while they are, you know, Level 3, for example, which is expanding and now is one of the largest international backbone networks, purchased one of their major competitors, Global Crossing, about 2 years ago now, or a year ago, they still have always just kind of squeaked by. Because capacity is always getting cheaper, the prices are always falling, the equipment is expensive, and we use more and more of it.
And increasingly, we're moving towards things like fiber optics as well. So where, you know, what is the trajectory of that, especially for these companies who are struggling to finance the last round?
Well, it grows in proportion. So, you know, the more, if when we have fiber to our homes and suddenly we're using 10 times as much bandwidth, then the center of the network has to provide for 10 times as much traffic. Which requires an upgrade and a new $30,000 piece of equipment. So, you know, who pays for that? And then who pays for the installation of that, which might take, you know, some poor person a week sitting on the floor of a cold room to do. And clearly, that's what's so remarkable to me is that, you know, yes, it all seems to happen automatically, but it's made by hand. You know, the connections are made literally by hand. Somebody has to take the router out of the box and put it in, and then somebody has to figure out which port to plug the yellow cable in and which port on the other side of the building it should go into Google's router into there. And that's a very deliberate, very slow process.
Who's doing that?
This sort of cast of network engineer.
And where do they come from? What's their makeup? Could they accidentally get it wrong, for example, and instead of plugging into the Google box, they plug into Lycos?
The best story. The best story of getting it wrong is a few years ago, a network engineer at Pakistan Telecom was told to block YouTube, and rather than blocking YouTube, he said, "I am YouTube." And that announcement of this route saying YouTube is over here, come knock on our door if you're looking for YouTube, quickly propagated around the world. So for about 2 hours, everyone looking for YouTube ended up in Pakistan Telecom's door, where YouTube was not, needless to say. And they eventually sorted it out. But it's indicative also of this kind of philosophical idea that the network engineers have a cone. That's be conservative in what you send and liberal in what you accept. So be careful what you announce to us, but we will be quite willing to believe anything you say. But that's all the more reason that you need to trust the networks you're connected to. And they like to say the network engineers want to make sure that that you are clueful, meaning the opposite of clueless. Because if we're going to connect our networks, then things could go really wrong. And I need to make sure you know what you're doing.
One final question. None of this has happened in a vacuum. We've got a great history of communications innovations, whether, the clear and obvious one that people often start at is the printing press and then often leap forward to the telegraph. Have we seen these kinds of dynamics throughout history? Is there anything that we can learn from looking back as we look forward?
One of the things that's so striking to me is how different this structure is of autonomous networks acting in their own self-interest from the top-down design of the telephone system. And particularly with the telephone system before it was broken up in different ways and deregulated. So if you have in the States an AT&T or here a BT saying, okay, let us mastermind this and say, where do we put the central offices? How do we connect all these switches in a way that makes the most logical sense? With the internet, it's been the opposite. It's each company saying, okay, where do we do it? And are we going to end up in the same place? And what's the most attractive place for us to all connect to each other? Which ends up with the creation of a building like Telehouse in London, which I sort of describe as the Heathrow of internet places, because it's kind of such a mess and has grown in this sort of ad hoc way, and yet unequivocally is one of the most important single buildings in the world where networks connect. But you would never design it that way, never in a million years.
But now it seems that we're having interesting post hoc regulation attempting to be applied, whether it's for for cybersecurity, which is often the excuse, or whether it's for whether it's for privacy regulation, particularly in Europe versus the US, or whether it's for copyright and all of these different types of things. We're starting to see governments and other organizations attempting to do a top-down service to this system. Is that something that's possible to you, do you think?
It seems so often very ham-fisted. It's almost as if sometimes the network engineers, I looked very closely when in the US when SOPA and PIPA came to the fore at the end of last year, and I checked in with some of the engineers who have been helping me to see what they thought, and they didn't think much because it was sort of preposterous. It would have been like regulating the airline industry and saying, okay, from now on, all planes must fly upside down. It was not something they could execute and therefore was not really relevant. If the moment came where their corporate parents said, this is the law, you must do it, they would have said, then it won't work.
Andrew Blum, author of Tubes, thank you very much for coming in.
Thanks for time.
That's it from us this week. Many thanks to Charles. You can read more on all these stories at guardian.co.uk/technology and keep up with the latest headlines throughout the week. I'm Alex Kratowski. The producer this week was Jason Phipps. We're back next Tuesday. See you then.
The Guardian has partnered with audible.co.uk to offer listeners a free audiobook when you sign up for a one-month, no-commitment trial of the Audible service. Audible has over 50,000 audiobook titles available to download. Go to guardian.co.uk/audible for further details.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.